opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the management or staff of Radio Kingston, WKNY. AM 1490, FM 1079, Kingston, New York.
Give myself to you completely.
Good morning and welcome to Nature Nuggets here on Radio Kingston. I'm Chris Baker and I'm filling in for Laurel Sutherland today, who's away. But make sure to tune in next week. Laurel will be back and actually will be broadcasting live in celebration of the expanded park area opening at Black Creek Preserve in Esopus. It's been a long time coming. I think it's in combination with Scenic Hudson and the John Burroughs Association. And so there'll be a live broadcast tomorrow, next Saturday, or better yet, you can go there in person. Nature Nuggets is Radio Kingston's resident nature show, which Laurel started to help expand our definition of community radio to embrace our more than human community as well. I always learn something new about the place where I live when I tune into Radio Kingston. And in this hour, we hope to help folks get to know the amazing biodiversity of plants, fungi, and all the abundant life we're so fortunate to share space with every day here in the Hudson Valley. Filling in for Laurel is always a joy and a very natural extension of the other work that I do in the community, as well as being a writer and an outdoor educator. I'm the founder of Chicory Naturalist, which is a nature-focused bookshop at the Kingston waterfront. If you haven't been to see us before, make sure to stop by. We're at 25 Broadway, and we have everything from books and field guides, board games, naturalist gear, art supplies, anything that kind of helps people connect with nature, as well as a community area in the back where we host some events. We try to have a little something for everyone because, after all, nature is for everyone. And now, more than ever, our living world needs every one of us to take an interest. As Laurel says, people won't fight for what they don't love, and they can't love what they don't know. So now it's time for Who's About Town, which is a segment a little like the Society Pages, but for people who consider trees big deal celebrities. This week, I am both loving and really suffering from blossoming trees due to my allergies, and apologies for the quality of my voice and any off-mic honks that might happen over the hour. You've probably noticed, especially if you've been down at the waterfront, our cottonwood trees have been dispersing their fluffy seeds en masse this week. At the Rondo, it could get really, looks like it's snowing half of the time this week of the year because seed fluff balls are like so thick in the air. The cottonwoods really love riparian habitat, which we're lucky to have. And yet this is also one of my absolute favorite weeks of the year. I said to my spouse yesterday that if we got married again, this is the week I'd want to do it because the bridal wreath spirea is still holding on and the black locust is in bloom. Black locust is a tree I really love in spite of the fact that it is considered invasive in our area. And to be very clear up front, I am not suggesting that anyone plant black locust on purpose. However, I think we can all appreciate its presence in our ecosystem since it is here. If you've never ID'd it before, this is a great time to do so because it's blossoming. It's a very tall, upright tree. It has kind of scraggly, tall branches that grow in interesting ways. It has a very deeply grooved bark that almost looks braided, pretty distinctive bark. And the leaves are compound, which means on one sprig, there's going to be a bunch of small oval leaves. And it's in the pea family, which is particularly obvious with its flowers because they look, if you've ever grown peas before, or you can think of something like a sweet pea flower. It's one of my favorite kinds of flowers in the plant world. And the ones on the black locust trees grow in clusters, like long drooping clusters. And right now, if you drive around and you see pretty tall trees that are just sort of drooping with all of these almost wisteria looking flowers, but they're white with little yellow accents, those are the black locust. And they're a little bit complicated because while they are invasive due to the way that they grow, they're not native to this habitat, and they grow very, very vigorously out of root suckers when you try to cut them down, which makes them kind of a nightmare if you're trying to control them on a piece of property. However, they also do a lot of good things for the environment as well. They are nitrogen fixing, just like all pea plants. And they usually move into sort of degraded soils very naturally. So they actually help like prevent erosion and fix nitrogen back into places that have been stripped, which, you know, other native trees do as well. So there are better options if you're looking to plant a tree. But the reason that they're in the area at all is because they were actually planted on purpose due to their virtues. And in the spirit of foraging, because my guest here today is one of my favorite foragers, they are also so delightfully delicious. The flowers specifically, no other part of the plant is to be eaten. Even the sprig that the flowers grow on is not edible, toxic. However, the flowers themselves are incredibly perfumed and edible. And you can infuse them into drinks. You can make like a black locust lemonade. And my favorite way to eat them is fried. So like I fried a whole sprig and then you kind of pull it off of the sprig when you eat it with like a beer batter. So that's just my little share for today. I'm going to be leading a abundance foraging sort of eat the weed style walk at Joppenburg, tomorrow. I think there's still a couple spots left on my website, chicorynaturalist.com. And that's one of the plants that I always try to do it this week of the year, because usually we'll get some black locusts in there too. So today I feel so fortunate to have a very dear friend and really a personal inspiration with me in the studio. Renee Bauman is a Catskills-based designer, chef, and nature enthusiast with a passion for wild plants and fungi. Trained as both an architect and a chef, she brings a creative, interdisciplinary flair to everything she does. Whether she's crafting baskets from local plants, illustrating mushrooms in watercolor, or whipping up delicious meals from foraged ingredients. Renee teaches workshops and techniques working with local fibers, with an emphasis on creating three-dimensional forms from bioregional components. Her work varies from traditional basketry pieces in cattail and willow to sculptural felt and spinning foraged fibers. Renee teaches workshops on identifying, cooking with, and weaving with plants and fungi growing in the Catskills. We'll be talking about some of the things she has coming up later, and I, on a personal level, strongly recommend learning from Renee. So thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks, Chris. So happy to be with you.
Oh my gosh, what a joy. And because I'm sure that you've been out in the woods a lot this week, I'm curious if you have any phenology observations, any who's about town to share with us today.
Well, I also have been noticing the locust blossoms just getting ready to go. I live just a little bit north of Kingston. So as I was driving down this morning, sort of watched that season come into fullness.
It's kind of a lovely thing that if you miss it somewhere, you can just go a little bit north or a little bit higher elevation and catch it again.
Yeah. Absolutely. We've had such a rainy last couple of weeks. Mm-hmm. That it's been a kind of uncommonly good morale season this year. So I've seen a lot of people, and I would imagine you're a person as well who gets texts from people saying, what is this mushroom?
I haven't gotten the morale text this year, which is surprising.
Yeah. I've had a few, or just people who know what it is, but it's sort of surprisingly shown up in their lawn or garden.
Actually, my cousin sent a picture of a morale that was like a hand and a half tall.
Yeah.
That she picked from her yard.
Yeah. I think right now some of the like late season ones that kind of can be the big chunky ones are showing up. So that's been really, I mean, morels are easy to love. So.
Yeah, absolutely. And especially when you do find them more abundantly, which is a little bit rare for us.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I've been doing a lot of, I also suffer from seasonal allergies.
Yes, we've talked about that.
Yes. I have been leaning hard on stinging nettle.
Okay.
And eating stinging nettle, which is really delicious.
It is so delicious.
Yeah. And for me, I know everyone's body is different. For me, that is hugely impactful on my seasonal allergies.
I'm willing to try anything at this point.
Yeah. Let's talk.
And also it's really, I think, when you, stinging nettle, also for listeners who might not be familiar, it does actually sting, but it's also incredibly rich in iron and it's a like a traditionally medicinal plant as well, and tastes sort of like, if you like, like if you like spinach, it's like extra of that sort of minerally green flavor.
Absolutely. Both stinging nettle and wood nettle are, I would almost say, if you're looking to get nutrition from a local plant, not just sort of flavor and the fun whimsy of, you know, eating a flower that you plucked off a tree, stinging nettle and wood nettle in this region would be the ones that I would say, know that plant if you're going to know one.
Yeah, you just have to bring gloves for harvesting.
Depends on your thresholds.
Okay. I have to bring gloves.
So it does depend on the age of the plant, how intense the stingers are. And if I find if you pluck sort of just the top couple of leaves off, it can be quite mild. If you're gathering a lot, that effect can accumulate. I tend to just go for it. But I think it's good to know that stinging sensation is one that's not harming your skin. It's not going to be something like poison ivy.
Doesn't stick around.
Yeah, it doesn't. It will stick around, but it's not actually harming your skin. It's doing that antihistamine goodness that some people actually do that as a treatment for pain and inflammation. Mm. Yeah,
like similar to bee stings.
I don't know. I always like know a tiny bit about plant medicine and herbs, and then have to give the disclaimer. I'm not an herbalist. Yeah.
Oh, thanks. Well, those are some wonderful observations. I love this time of year so much. And to get into our conversation a little bit, I'm curious, or for the listeners, what drew you? Because I know you, like I am a transplant, we are transplants to this area, but we are pretty deeply rooted here. And I am curious what drew you to this biome in particular, and sort of what made you decide to plant your roots here.
Yeah, great question. It was sort of happenstance. I was living in the city and working in the city, and was working in restaurants at the time. And the restaurant that I was a chef at that moment was looking to open another location, and sort of my business partner at the time knew that I was an outdoors person and thought I might be amenable to a location a little bit more in the country, in the mountains, and I was. So started splitting time between the city and the Catskills to open a restaurant. And now I am not in restaurants anymore.
Congratulations.
But I'm still here. Yes. Yeah. I'm still here really because of the community. And a lot of the community and culture and things that I loved about living in New York City, I've found a lot of kinship here, but also with really easy access to beautiful, interesting outdoor places.
Yeah. I feel like that's a really relatable story for a lot of people in terms of the...
Yeah.
It's like some of the things that feel irreplaceable in more densely urban areas, you realize, actually kind of can be.
Yeah.
You're like, oh, there's actually a lot going on even in more rural communities.
Absolutely. So, yeah. And I was in kind of the local food sourcing area of restaurant work, really trying to use as many ingredients that were grown locally. And that's usually defined as within 300 miles. So for New York City, a lot of that is grown in the Hudson Valley.
Yeah.
So I had a lot of contact with people working in alternative agriculture in the Hudson Valley, and having this kind of sense that those were my people. And they're still here. Still my people. Yeah. Still your
people. Now you could just get to actually hang out more.
Yeah.
And as far as foraging goes, so you were already an outdoors person in the city. But like, what was you have sort of like a gradual entry into becoming someone who worked with and harvested plants and fungi, or was there sort of like a down the rabbit hole moment for you?
Both. So my childhood, I actually grew up on the West Coast, and I was lucky enough to grow up knowing some wild plants where I lived in Oregon.
Did that come through your family?
I truly don't remember. It must have been through my family. But yeah, I can remember eating wood sorrel and blackberries and wild strawberries and huckleberries growing up as a kid. And so that felt really natural to me in that environment. And then, you know, fast forward to living in the city and having gone to culinary school. And I really did not know the biome here at all. I didn't have that same familiarity of having grown up with things. And just started learning as a hobby and way to combine being outside with learning plants. And honestly, a big motivation for me was looking for interesting flavors. That when you're able to connect with a plant, it's often a wild plants are not going to have the same flavor palette as plants that you get at the grocery store necessarily. And that was really alluring to me.
That's actually, I think that's a really awesome point to sort of expand upon a little bit, because I think it both speaks to the like allure of, as you say, of foraging, and also some of the caution around it. Is like, can you talk a little bit about sort of the compounds that, or like why there are so many more flavors in wild plants? And like,
are you talking about you know, things that have toxicity?
Yeah, or? Well, I'm thinking about like the saponins, the oxalic acid, like all the things that are like delicious and also problematic in large quantities, kind of.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of complexity in how we talk about wild plants and fungi as food. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I wonder if we put the same scrutiny on food that we got from the grocery store, would we be having the same conversations? So there's a lot of foods that we regularly eat that, if they were in a field guide, would say caution, toxic, and there's a different part of the plant that is toxic. And of course, this is stuff that you need to know if you're going to be harvesting your own food.
You mean in terms of there's other parts of the plant that we don't eat?
And things that just we don't have as much exposure to in terms of a regular diet. So science might tell you you shouldn't eat this every meal of every day for the rest of your life, that might cause you some health problems. For me, the most convincing arguments are foods that are traditionally eaten. There's ethnographic evidence in terms of their being used over time in populations. So I'm also a culinary person. So culinary traditions and history feel really grounding to me in that. So I would be a little bit more cautious if someone is really trying to replace something in their diet or use a plant really heavily in a way that it hasn't been done historically. Then you're kind of going into experimental territory there.
Yeah, makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
I guess I was thinking too about how like the domesticated versions of a lot of plants that we eat, you know, I don't know, think about like wild mustards or something, that it's like as plants are bred for agricultural purposes, like they tend so much more towards like the sweet away from bitter. And so it's like by seeking wild greens, we can like, or like wild plants have so much more, like punchy flavors, like sour, bitter flavors that that people tend to breed away from.
Absolutely.
And but then also part of what makes them more bitter and
interesting.
And interesting is also that they have more of those compounds and less sweet flavors, which also maybe if it's more of a culinary tradition, I wonder if also people might be more better adapted in terms of their gut microbiome or something to be able to like process more compounds that I'm like purely speculating right now, but
yeah, there's so many ways to speculate, and there's such variation within a season. I always try to point out too, when you go to the grocery store, you're often getting, or the farmer's market, you're getting vegetables that were harvested, not just grown and selected to have particular genetics that have a reproducible, advantageous end product, but they're also harvested at a really exact moment. When you are wild harvesting a plant for food, you're also making a lot of judgments about how old it is. Is it flowering? Is it? And a lot of times they're not just, haven't just been selected to be sweeter or less bitter, but also bigger and more tender. So there's like textural differences and size differences. So there's a lot of things that you're kind of selecting out. And if you're a person who likes kind of interesting, funky, bitter flavors, there might be a lot in wild food that you're like, I've never tasted something like this before.
For sensation seeking people.
Yeah. And I also will add to that, the culinary preparations really make a big difference. Some greens that are bitter and just unpalatable if you're eating them raw, depending on how you prepare them, can be completely palatable. So that's where the like skill as a chef and how you blend flavors, how you cook them can make a huge difference in like the product as a plant, quote unquote product, and what you've prepared that's ready to eat.
Absolutely. Yeah. Like how, yes. Which I think goes for a lot of foods, but it's not as keenly obvious sometimes.
Yeah.
Yeah,
for sure.
Great. Well, I'd love to talk more about this. We need to take a little break for some words from the community, and we'll be back in just a moment with Renee Bauman.
Hi, I'm Katie Scott Childress, president of the Ulster County Library Association. If you're an Ulster County resident, you now have online access to 5 major daily newspapers for free. The Ulster County Library Association is providing the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, the Chicago Tribune, and the Los Angeles Times to read online. The newspaper subscriptions are supported by funds from the Ulster County Legislature. As librarians, we want to ensure that people have access to reputable news sources so that you don't hit a paywall when you're trying to learn about important events. You just need a library card, and library cards are free. You can get one at your local library or on their website. To find out more or access the papers, click Read at the Ulster County Library Association's website, uclib.org.
Radio Kingston.
Many voices.
Many voices.
Many voices.
One community.
Hi, Warren Lawrence here, inviting you to join me Saturday afternoons for the original Solid Gold Weekend. We take you on a musical journey back to rock and roll's first 3 decades, the 1950s, 60s, the 70s, all the great music from that era. We take your requests. We play them, of course. Your chance to win. We have contests every hour and some special guests dropping by as well throughout the show. That's the original Solid Gold Weekend, remembering the golden years of rock and roll. Every Saturday from noon till 6 here on Radio Kingston, AM 1490, FM 107.9, and anytime at RadioKingston.org.
Ulster Immigrant Defense Network is hosting a bilingual family support playgroup in the Hello Friends Early Learning Community Room on Wednesday, May 28th. This group is designed for parents of children under 3. Older siblings are welcome to attend. The meeting will have a space for kids to play, discussion topics, and parenting resources. This event is free to attend. Space is limited and registration is required. Bilingual Family Support Playgroup, Wednesday, May 28th from 10:30 to 11:30 a.m. in the community room at Hello Friends Early Learning, 437 New Paltz Road in Highland. To register and for more information, head to ulsterimmigrantdefensenetwork.org. All right. Welcome back to Nature Nuggets on Radio Kingston. I'm Chris Baker, filling in for Laurel Sutherland, and I'm here today with forager, fiber artist, outdoor guide, Renee Bauman. And we've been talking about the culinary side of foraging up to now and got down some interesting rabbit holes. But I'd like to take a little left turn, because I also want to make sure we talk about fibers. I mean, you're such like a naturalist polymath, I think. Like, I'm so in awe of the way that your interests and abilities kind of just like myceliate out into the the world that you're interested in. And I think your passion for, and then also the way that you share your skills with basketry kind of stand, or you're sort of a standout within our community, I would say. And I'm curious how you got into making baskets, and like, how did you learn from, or who did you learn from? Like, how did you first get hooked on that?
Kind of similar answer to foraging. I had some exposure as a kid and learned from a book how to make my first basket.
Oh my gosh, really?
Yeah. My grandmother had all sorts of craft books and was kind of a very crafty person who could do just about anything. And had a book on pine needle raffia basketry, which was this like fad, I think, in the 1800s. But I had a pine tree in my front yard, and of the West Coast pines that have really long needles.
Yeah.
And made my first basket from, was enticed by this idea that I could go into my yard and gather materials to make something from.
That's so funny. I have a book on pine needle basketry at Chicory, and I love the idea of like a little Renee of the future finding
like,
that
I can
in
do
their
this.
Parents'
house. Yeah. Yeah. and then I really hadn't touched anything with basketry for years and years. And weirdly enough, I was doing a chef gig and making a that involved building a cob oven and baking bread. And I needed bread baskets that were really particular size and to fit the oven naturally. And I just decided I'm going to remember how to bake baskets. I'm going to just do this. This is
the easiest thing. Is like Martha Stewart of the woods. Like what?
It really was some choices.
Made the oven
some
and
choices
the
were made. Yes. So I bought reed, which is usually rattan reed, to make those baskets. You know, at this time, I was also just exploring in my cooking ways to use things that were grown locally or wild foraged, and was like, I want to also know what the materials are that would work for making baskets. And then I went down that rabbit hole and have not yet emerged. So did a couple of years of just exploring, trying to learn from other people in the area. There are a few other basket makers regionally who are incredible artists. Katie Grove has, I think she has an amazing new book that is going to be coming out this year.
Oh, that's exciting.
Wild basketry. And then I also have been fortunate enough to study with Jess Clark of Willowvale Farm in the Hudson Valley. And they have an incredible farm of willows and have really done a lot of studying with artisan basket makers. So like learning the willow weaving techniques, which are quite different, with them has been really amazing. And yeah, it's super specific and helpful to like learn the body part of making a basket. Like, this is going to work if you hold it this way, and if you hold it with your other hand, it's going to break. And that's something that you wouldn't learn from just looking at a finished project or watching a video on YouTube.
Right. The sort of like impulse to not look at the IKEA furniture guy before you start IKEA. I feel like, well, that's, I'm speaking on a personal level. I feel like basketry is this because it's, I mean, cross-culturally, across so many thousands of years, like it's such an incredible art form.
Absolutely.
That there's so much knowledge to be passed.
Some people say it's the oldest.
Really?
Yeah.
Like before pottery?
Before pottery. Yeah. There's actually theories that pottery originated as an applique to baskets, to make like a sealed vessel before the full technique of like building things from just clay and firing it.
That's fascinating,
isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Also surprising because it seems much harder to weave than to make a pinch pot. But
I mean, yeah, pinch pots seem pretty, but I mean, there are woven vessels that are incredibly basic and simple as well. Yeah, but it's definitely an ancient practice.
Yeah. Also, so, I mean, yeah, I love that. But so part of what you've been doing is absorbing these ancient techniques, and also part of it is looking at the materials that you have in front of you, basically, like seeing what can be done with materials at hand.
Yeah, absolutely. I wouldn't consider myself like a historical basket maker or trying to, my primary interest isn't recreating things in any way that they were in the past. I really want to make the things that I want to exist. So I want the bread baskets that are the size that I want them. And yeah. I want the foraging backpack that is the right shape for me and going into the woods and gathering mushrooms.
Yeah. Okay. Quick pitch. And we'll go over more of Renee's offerings at the end. But Renee Bauman, BAUMANN.com. Check out.
It's reneemakes.com.
Oh, that's so much easier. Okay. reneemakes.com. And check out the foraging basket. I mean, the baskets are so beautiful. I'm curious how, like, so as you've been working with plants and fungi, like sort of how that process of looking more at the many uses that you have to for them, like how that has changed sort of your relationship to the land, the more that your knowledge around foraging and fiber arts has grown.
I mean, I think the two biggest ways are, one, just knowing more about it, you know, knowing what different plants are and what a catkin looks like when it's unfurling and what willow looks like in the winter and when it should be cut back. So just a much deeper knowledge about what's happening in different environments over the course of a year. And then the other is really like I've sort of accidentally built a seasonality for myself to do the things that I want to do. So right now is kind of foraging season. A lot of plants are in season right now, and fungi are going to be entering their peak in a month or so. And that's when I really concentrate on that work. And then fall and winter starts to move into a more fiber-centric moment where I'm teaching a lot of fiber, and the time to harvest willow is in the winter or very early spring, which kind of coincides with not as much happening in terms of food plants. Why is that the time to harvest? So I work with two main materials for basketry, and I work with them for different reasons. One material is cattail, and most of the basketry that I teach is using cattail leaves. And there's a couple reasons for that. I really like to make these workshops that I'm teaching accessible to people so that you can have that same connection with the land. Like, oh, I can go out and find a patch of cattails and I know how to make something with it. If you take that away, I'm so thrilled. and cattails are fairly easy to identify. They're fairly common and really resilient. So it's an ecologically reasonable thing to do to encourage people to harvest cattail leaves. And the season for harvesting cattail is after they've fully flowered. So that's going to be in like late August or early September. And before the leaves have started to turn brown. So they start to sort of wilt and die back and they lose strength. So that's the season for harvesting cattail. But then at that point, you can weave with it for as long as you can store it, basically. I haven't aged out of any stored leaves at this point. I've had some around for a couple of years that are still good to weave with.
Oh wow, that's kind of a wonderful material to have. That's not like a right or wrong time to.
Yeah, with a lot of this stuff, if you harvest it and you store it properly, then you can extend the time that you can use it.
That's wonderful.
And then the other material that I work a lot with is willow. And willow is not like a weeping willow, but it's kind of the willow that you might see on stream beds that is...
Oh, it's not a weeping willow.
It's not a weeping willow.
Oh, I have been misunderstanding this.
Willow is a crazy... I believe everything in the genus Salix is some sort of willow, but you have everything from teeny tiny shrubs to giant weeping willow trees within that genus. And... not all of those are for weaving. It's a much smaller subset of different species that are good for weaving. So it's going to be like upright trees that grow in kind of watery stream bed type areas. That's the willow that you want for weaving. So as with the case with a lot of trees, if you're going to be pruning or cutting them back, you want to do that in their dormant season. So for a willow, that's anytime after the leaves have fallen off in the fall and before they've sent out their buds and catkins in the early spring. Mm. And willow is one of the earliest to come out in spring. So you want to cut it back before it does that so it can send all of its energy into new growth rather than into a sprig that you're going to be cutting off.
So similarly, the plant can still thrive even though you're taking the material from
Absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. It's just changing the direction that that energy is going.
That's wonderful. And I sort of, I'm sorry, I detoured you too. So you were saying that the crafts that you're involved with now sort of have changed your relationship by like creating a seasonality to your year.
Yeah.
And like these rhythms that take you from one season to the next.
Absolutely.
I think that's really like, yeah. I feel like with most naturalist pursuits, that's kind of, I think I've never really put words around it, but that does seem to underpin it where, you know, it's like if you're really hardcore into mushrooms and you only get to check out mushrooms a certain part of the year, eventually you're sort of like, I wonder what the birds are doing here in early April. And there's not a lot else, right? You know, your curiosity blossoms, it kind of guides you to other parts of the year too.
Yeah. Or even like last year, there was a drought at the end of the summer and I knew like it was not, there weren't mushrooms around. And I decided, all right, this is the year I'm going to try processing dogbane. So I went down a little different rabbit hole. And dogbane is a beautiful native plant that has really strong what's called bast fibers. And it's traditionally used for making all sorts of textiles. So it is a very time and labor intensive process that's also very beautiful. But I decided I had bandwidth to go down that rabbit hole because I was not spending my time out looking for mushrooms in a dry forest.
Yeah, that, I mean, that makes a lot of sense. Are bast fibers the part inside the plant? Like,
So bast fibers are long fibers that are, the word actually comes from the same word root as basswood trees, because that's like one of the most important traditional bast fibers. So it's in the inner bark. There's these linear fibers that grow and different plants have different ways of processing them. And the oldest textiles that we have are made with bast fibers. So the oldest textiles are actually linen. So that's my shirt today is linen. but that's made from flax. It's the bast fibers of flax. And you're kind of breaking off the straw type material and then often partly letting the other plant material decompose in a process called redding, and then separating it out. And if you do it just right, you end up with kind of long, strong, soft fibers that can be processed into textiles. And this is traditionally done with basswood, with nettle, stinging nettle, and dogbane in this area. More plants than that too, but those are some common ones in this area. Yeah.
So amazing. It's really beautiful. Like if you just listening to you say that, like you kind of have to picture all of the like patience and experimentation of ancestors trying to work with materials that to meet their needs for different kinds of materials. And yeah, it's just, it's so amazing how much people have figured out just through experimentation, probably, you know, like.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's technology too.
Oh, definitely.
Like figuring out how to make a net from, I mean, it would take me a long time to make a net. I could do it, but this is, we all come from people who knew how to do that.
Yeah. Out from nothing. And I guess that's a good segue to my next question, which was, why does sharing this knowledge with others feel important to you? Because I know, like, I mean, there are plenty of artisans who focus on production to, you know, to show in galleries or to sell. And I know you do some of that, but a lot of your focus is on education. And I'm curious why that's such a guiding light for you.
Well, I do have to say I am the daughter of two educators.
Yeah.
So that probably is steeped in my bones a little bit. And it was really accidental. After deciding that leaving the restaurant industry was going to be the move for me, just was kind of casually sharing things that I was feeling really passionate about and inspired by. And people asked me if I would do an event or share. And you're right, I have explored some other of those avenues in terms of production making or art making, and have found some of those to be resonant, but really giving people the experience of connecting to nature feels like the most profound thing that I could do. And even sometimes if you're making, like if I have a vision and making something, a beautiful gallery piece, you still might end up removed from that versus having an experience where you're harvesting cattails and knowing how to make a basket. Like that feels like that can be really profound.
Well, and I love at events that we've been at together, the way that it can be also become like a larger group experience, and like the baskets that you've made using so many different hands. And so that's also like what the end result I feel like has just like a different energy too, of like of something that was not like a single hand, a single genius behind it, but is like this like community weaving in a very literal sense.
Yeah, a lot of the way that that art and art making is structured is so isolated, and that feels really strange, and is not how we evolved. To and how these crafts evolved, like they really are meant to be shared in community, and yeah,
I think about something like quilting or something that it's like such a communal,
absolutely, yeah, nature, and like. Learning from a group, and it's even something that I struggle with sometimes in structuring workshops is to get to a finished start to finish object is a little bit trickier than it would be if we were all just sitting around a table at night chit chatting. And spending a little bit of time crafting together, you don't have to learn all of the things at once in that
right,
scenario, yeah. Which you do in a like start to finish workshop.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I'm thinking about like some like herbalists I know who offer like education, but it's like you have to sign up for a season.
Yeah.
it's like, sorry, there's no way to do this.
Yeah.
In an afternoon, you have to come back consistently for at least a season, and that kind of it makes sense because a lot of work is more iterative. Like it's through the repetition that you really get it in your bones too.
For sure, there's definitely like a deeper knowledge that you can get in those spaces, and there's so many people who are living busy lives and like figuring out how to make this knowledge accessible to people feels also like part of the design and
totally.
Creativity around sharing this.
I love that. And I think you mentioned a little bit earlier, but what do you most hope that people will take away from going to a workshop?
I think like any amount of like connection to the natural world, like you just walk by something and see a plant differently, or you walk by a basket and flip it over to look and see how it's made. Those feel like those have been profound moments for me, and things that have changed the way that I look in the world going forward and like never can go back.
Yeah.
So anything that's even close to that would be an incredible result of an experience for me.
I love that. And then I know that we've talked about this on a personal level, but I was thinking about as we're exploring foraging, and I have a foraging, we both have actually foraging walks this weekend, like how you conceive of like an honorable harvest. I know this is a term that Robin Wall Kimmerer, the indigenous botanist, has written many beautiful books, including most recently The Service Berry, but like in Braiding Sweetgrass, that's the word she puts around it is honorable harvest. And I feel like she has a framework based on her indigenous heritage that she that her framework for it, but I feel like everybody who takes from the land has to have sort of a like how they interpret that idea of an honorable harvest. And I was wondering what that means to you.
To me personally, or to me when I'm educating other people?
Is that different?
I think it's different.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm curious. Well, both, maybe.
To me personally, I'm trying to give back as well. And it's a little bit more of a feeling. So to me, I'm definitely taking from people who I've learned from, including Robin Wall Kimmerer, many influential and inspirational writings. And another teacher who I was lucky enough to work with in the Sierras where I grew up with, and had a concept of learned a practice of introducing yourself to land, which has felt really profound to me. And it can feel a little bit silly going through these steps. From reading Robin Wall Kimmerer as well, like the ask permission and give thanks. But going through literally asking out loud with your voice or literally introducing yourself is a practice that it's hard to not feel a change when you're going through that. Like we feel a little bit silly talking to the ground or to the land. And when you're doing that, I do think there's something that changes in your perception, especially over time, and asking permission. Is it okay to take this little snip from your branch, to take this flower?
I mean, that makes so much sense, because however it is received by the other life present, it in your own head, that confers a sense of personhood to the environment, you know, which I think then changes how you interact with it, right?
Absolutely. And then on the other side, this slides a little bit into the education component. I think so many of us have grown up with a real distance from and not having an understanding of nature and plants. And I've experienced, both with myself and with other people, a real fear around interacting with nature in any way that could harm it. And even a sense of like, I don't know if I should be here, if you're in a really special place, that I think is an incorrect assumption based on a mythology that nature exists without humans. You know, there has to be an understanding that these like wild and beautiful places have always had human interaction, and it can be beneficial and it can be harmful.
This is actually the last person that I had on Nature Nuggets was Luke Sarantonio, and we had this exact moment of that there is no distance, actually, like that the people are part of it, and also that the landscape that anybody has known here for thousands of years is profoundly influenced by human behaviors.
Absolutely. So that can come to an interesting point, where if you're asking permission, is it from the plant? Is it okay to take this? Is it okay to take your leaves? Is it okay to pull you up by the root? To me, that's where a really important component is curiosity and knowledge. So I try to, as an educator, depending on the amount of time that I get to spend with someone, just present my perspective. So if I'm harvesting garlic mustard, I'm pulling it up by the roots. Here's why I'm pulling it up by the roots. If I'm harvesting a ramp, maybe I'm pulling one leaf. Why might I be harvesting it in that particular way? So it requires some knowledge about the plant or the fungus and how harvesting impacts it to be able to even understand what asking permission looks like, to have context to even interpret that.
Yeah. And it's sort of a virtuous cycle that, like, the more that you know, the more informed the consent can be. Yeah,
a huge example of this for my learning was with harvesting willow. That the practice of coppicing willow is cutting the entire plant to within a few inches of the ground. And I did not understand this or know this when I was just experimenting and trying to learn. And that, to me, who's not a farmer or an ecologist, felt like, oh, this is would obviously be too stressful on the plant. It would really be harming the plant. I'll just take one branch here. And that is not accurate. So in that way, like, knowing the way that the plant works and this relationship that we've developed over thousands of years of coppicing, what looks like it might be something that's really extractive or taking a lot from the environment is actually just training the plant to grow in this symbiotic relationship with humans. So it's changing the shape of how it grows. It actually extends the life of the plant and makes it grow a wider root system. So it's a really beautiful interaction
that's beautiful.
Could look like you're cutting down this plant and taking all of its plant matter away. So there are things that might have a surprising relationship in that context.
Yeah. Oh gosh, that's a great example. Yeah. Also a shout out to the book Sproutlands. It's a really beautiful exploration of coppicing. All right. So we have to take a quick break for some words from the community, and we'll be back in just a few minutes with more from Renee Bauman.
Hi, this is Lorraine from the Kingston Farmers Market. We're open every Saturday from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. in the county courthouse parking lot. The market is bigger than ever this year, with over 80 vendors this season. We have all of your favorite vendors with fruit, vegetables, eggs, meat, fish, cheese, and plenty of new ones, too. With live music every week, community groups, and seasonal events. Our Pop Bucks program lets kids try new veggies. We accept SNAP and offer Fresh Connect checks. Find us at the info booth to find out more. That's the Kingston Farmers Market in the county courthouse parking lot, uptown, Saturdays, 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. Check us out on Facebook and Instagram to stay up to date on everything the market has to offer. Or visit us online at kingstonfarmersmarket.org.
Hi, I'm Teresa Whitman from I Want What She Has. Every Monday afternoon from 1 to 3, we're amplifying women's voices.
Yeah. Women had power through talk.
And their stories.
My curiosity outweighs any fear.
Highlighting how women are living life on their own terms.
I don't want to follow the rules anymore. I want to do what I want to do that feels good.
And breaking free from patriarchal structures.
But misbehaving is really just stepping outside the confines of society.
Going deep into systems change.
Sure, astrology can be revolutionary if it's obstructive to capitalism because you don't go to work because it's a full moon or whatever, you know?
And how we take care of ourselves and each other. That's I Want What She Has, your weekly antidote to the patriarchy. Monday afternoons from 1 to 3 here on Radio Kingston, AM 1490, FM 107.9, or anytime on radiokingston.org.
Welcome back to Nature Nuggets. I'm Chris Baker, filling in for Laurel Sutherland today. And today my guest is Renee Bauman, who is a local forager, weaver, guide to the outdoor world. And I want to make sure before the end of the program that we have a chance to talk about some of the ways that people can get involved with or learn from Renee, of which I think there will be many this summer. But before that, I wanted to ask a sort of final question, which is, in the spirit of the season's abundance, What's something that you used to completely overlook in the environment that you now get so excited when you find it? Like something that seemed boring to you, and now you are like enthusiastic to greet when you see it?
I have a very basic answer, which is just mushrooms. That yeah, I, you know, didn't have any knowledge of mushrooms, and it felt incredibly intimidating to try to learn them, and really just going for hikes to de-stress up in the Catskills and being shocked by all of the different colors and textures that I saw, and just felt like, okay, I have to learn this. It's intimidating, but I got to do it. Yeah. And like, there's few things that make me just like gasp and laugh out loud in joy to myself in the middle of the forest by myself.
I always think about if you have like the Merlin app on at any given time, the sort of outbursts that it'll record.
Wow. Yeah. A lot of times it is like just laughing in joy to see something so beautiful. How delightfully weird is that?
No, that's a really great answer. I didn't know what I would get from that. I was just curious because I feel like they're, speaking to the, when you're saying that you can't go backwards from the knowledge that you gather, I think, the idea of like plant blindness is so rampant in our culture, because it's so much of this knowledge is generational and has not been passed on. Once you like start to see things and recognize them,
Can't turn it off.
You can't turn it off. And isn't that beautiful?
It's beautiful. I love that.
So I know that you have a lot going on this summer, and I'm curious, is the walk that you have later today filled up already?
So that is actually at a private venue.
Oh, that's private. Okay,
yeah,
great. Okay.
Yeah.
So of the public walks that you have and other education that you have going on, or if people want to connect with you to maybe set something up, how can people get involved?
Yeah, so I do have a couple of public events. Actually, the best way to know all of the things that's going on is to either sign up through my website to be on my mailing list, which is not just kind of seasonally what events I have going on, or connect with me on social media. On Instagram, I'm Renee Makes Things, and there's a little underscore between the words. And I try to keep things updated there. Over the next 2 weeks, I have a couple of events that there's some options to spend some time with me. I have a foraging walk next weekend, so it's Memorial Day weekend, at West Kale Brewing. So we'll be doing a little foraging walk and wild food tasting, and you get a beer. Yeah.
That's a fun event.
It's a really fun one. It's a really, really beautiful little place, too.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Oh, yeah, time to spend a little bit of the weekend. So you can definitely pre-register for that, is recommended because it's a holiday weekend.
Is that on at West Kale or on your website?
That is on my website.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, they should link to it as well. Yeah. And then I have a beret workshop. There is a farm in Lake Katrine called the Healing Acres. And among other things, they have some alpacas. And we're going to be making berets from alpaca fiber, which is so lovely. Oh,
that's
and
so cute.
Really unusual to be able to. I've never even heard of anyone doing anything this wild. To be able to make a finished garment from fibers in one day. This is another rabbit hole that I went down just figuring out how to do it. And you don't have to be good at any other fiber arts to do this. Felting is a
good
total
beginner.
Yeah, it's not at all like knitting or sewing or embroidery. It's much more like physical. You're like rolling stuff back and forward and getting soap suds on your hands, and in the end you have a hat that you made.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, also the berets. Yeah, again, check out reneemakes.com because the pictures will make you want to go and do it yourself. That's fabulous. I want to also shout out today, starting in 1 minute and going till 4 p.m., At John Burroughs Slabsides in West Park. The John Burroughs Association will be holding Slabsides open for tours from 11 to 4 p.m. with refreshments. You can also come for a walk with me, Abundance Foraging, tomorrow at chicorynaturalist.com. And thanks you so much. And thanks for Renee for being here. Thanks for everybody for listening here on Radio Kingston. And make sure to tune in next week when Laurel will be broadcasting live at the celebration of the expanded park area at Black Creek Preserve in Esopus. Please feel free to email us with suggestions or questions by contacting naturenuggets@radiokingston.com. And you can also follow the Nature Nuggets Instagram account, which is at HV Nature Nuggets. Thanks, Chris.
Life, I give myself to you. Completely on.